Hello and welcome to Viewpoints on today's show. I'll be out and journalist Mike McCullough will be in with the documentary produced in Abbotsford, British Columbia.
Everyone I've ever loved is dead from opiates.
My best friend died of an overdose.
Zachary, he was one of my closest friends.
It has been more than 8 years since public health officials in British Columbia sounded the alarm that users of illicit drugs were dying at greater rates than historically observed.
Twice a day I OD'd.
What?
Yeah. I think I've OD'd over 300 and some odd times. Like, I know guys that have OD'd over 200, 300, 400 times, like, kind of like me, but then I've heard of other people that have OD'd that many times, and then the last time was the last time. And that was it. They couldn't bring the person back.
Today, more than 15,000 people have died in the province since BC declared the toxic drug overdose death crisis a public health emergency in April of 2016.
We need to change the way society thinks of people that use drugs.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello and welcome to the special edition of Viewpoints. My name is Boris Desain. I'm off on vacation and Mike McCullough in Abbotsford, BC will be taking up the job for the next 2 weeks to tell us more about the opioid crisis in BC. He spoke with the former provincial health officer of BC, Dr. Perry Kendall, who, as we said in our opening, sounded the alarm that people using illicit drugs were dying at greater rates than historically observed. In this in-depth documentary, we'll also hear about people at the center of the crisis in and around the Fraser Valley. That includes people addicted to street drugs, the people who support them through harm reduction efforts and through peer support. Please note that we agreed on a case-by-case basis to identify some interview subjects in this piece by their first name only. This was granted due to the stigma of drugs and people who use them. So here's Mike McCullough in Abbotsford, BC.
British Columbia says that on the average day, more than six people in the province die of an illicit drug overdose. Fentanyl, a highly potent and highly addictive opioid, has been detected in the toxicology of between 82 and 87% of confirmed and suspected unregulated drug deaths over most of the years of the overdose death crisis. The lone outlier was in 2016, when fentanyl and its analogs were detected in the toxicology of two-thirds of overdose victims. But beyond these cold, hard facts and figures, I wanted to get a greater understanding of the human side of this tragedy. For this piece, for Viewpoints, and for the Local Journalism Initiative, I spoke with folks directly at the center of the crisis, starting with people struggling with addiction, whether actively using street drugs or at some stage of recovery.
I personally am addicted to opiates.
I also met with people who spoke of friends and loved ones that they've lost.
Everyone I've ever loved is dead from opiates.
My best friend died of an overdose.
Zachary, he was one of my closest friends.
That was a hard one.
I spoke with several people who work in harm reduction, which is essentially an umbrella of services that seeks to prevent undue additional harm to drug users and the surrounding community beyond the drug use itself. Folks who make up a patchwork of services offered around the Fraser Valley, such as frontline outreach workers like Ernestine O'Rourke.
We need to change the way society thinks of people that use drugs.
I also spoke with Will McClellan from Mountainside Harm Reduction Society. He operates a mobile drug testing lab which lets people try to get a better understanding of what exactly is in their stash.
My job is necessary because the drug supply as it stands is incredibly toxic and treacherous.
And I spoke with peers, people who form an additional layer in the continuum of care around the crisis, and their lived experience often overlaps with the experiences of drug users.
A peer is like we're like-minded. We have things in common. So say like you and I both really like baseball and we went to a baseball game together, we'd be like peers on that level.
Hey, my name is Zeph.
peer support worker in the Fraser Valley.
And peers can be found around various places in the community, from supervised consumption sites, shelters, or out and about meeting drug users where they are. Peers are often on the front lines of preventing overdoses, using naloxone, and training others to do the same. They distribute harm reduction supplies and information, such as offering help to navigate various social services, for instance. And I spoke with Dr. Perry Kendall. Dr. Kendall was the provincial health officer of BC from 1999 until 2018. And notably, he was the PHO in 2016 when he declared the public health emergency into the crisis. Here's Dr. Kendall with a look at the decade or so leading up to the emergency declaration.
From about 2000 to 2010, we had 200 roughly per annum drug overdose deaths a year in this province. And they were mostly drug deaths due to heroin, although there's a lot of polypharmacy going on. People use alcohol, people use benzodiazepines, people use speed and heroin together. Were very common. Then we noticed in about 2012, 13, 14, the numbers started going up quite markedly. And that was clearly associated with the toxicology change in the drug market. And it was due to, it was traced back to the importation of fentanyl and fentanyl analogs, which are drugs that are many tens of times stronger than the original drug heroin, which is stronger itself than morphine, which is stronger itself than opium, the poppy derivatives.
Dr. Kendall says the potency of fentanyl is not only what makes it so risky, but since it takes a smaller amount in bulk for an effective dose, the drug is more easily smuggled, resold, and profited from. A textbook case of the iron law of prohibition.
If you prohibit a substance, alcohol, for example, rather than sell beer, which is bulky and low alcohol content, people move to selling spirits, which are more concentrated, get more of a bang for the buck, and more return for the same risk. So the iron law of prohibition says if you prohibit something but people want it, then they will find a way to get it, and the black market will happen, along with a lot of other things, including lack of quality control, lack of oversight, criminalizing not only the people who sell and produce the stuff, but the people who use it as well.
Dr. Kendall looks back to policy decisions leading up to today's crisis that pushed opiate users into doing business on the black market.
If you look to the United States, during this period of time, they were suffering from clearly an overprescription of synthetic opioids such as oxycodone. And so millions of prescriptions were being written, and they were tending to go to people who were disempowered, disemployed, unemployed. If you talk about the Rust Belt of America, all the jobs going to overseas to lower wage markets. There was an increase in the deaths of despair, an increase in prescriptions, and we had oxycodone pill mills being set up. And so you had millions of people taking oxycodone, which is a very strong painkiller, an opioid, becoming dependent upon it. And the policy decision that was made at the time is, let's get doctors to stop prescribing. The drug will be out of the way, and we'll solve the problem that way. That's pretty fundamentally stupid, because if you have people dependent upon a substance, and the substance is no longer there from one source, you can pretty much bet your boots and somebody's going to move in with another source.
Dr. Kendall says first heroin, then fentanyl filled the void. And thus, the overdose crisis was born. I spoke with a self-reported drug user in Mission about his first-hand experiences and have agreed to only partially name him due to the stigma associated with drug use. Aaron's story with drugs didn't begin on the side of the road across the street from Haven in the Hollow shelter on Logan Avenue, but instead, a fall from a ladder put Aaron in a hospital bed with a prescription to morphine to manage the pain.
And then they were like, okay, your back's better, we're cutting you off. They didn't wean me down, they didn't do anything, they just cut me right off, and that was it. And 3 days later, I was sweating, and I was so sick, and I just called the guy up and said, I need something, and he said, okay, I'll come on over, and there it begins.
Rose Foster shares a similar story.
I was on morphine 5 times a day for pain management. they cut me off cold turkey, so I needed to find something to substitute it with. I'm not saying it was the right thing, but you don't wake up the next morning and say, hey, I want to be a drug addict.
Aaron says he doesn't choose to live like this. He's hooked, in spite of having survived hundreds of overdoses.
One time it was, I think it was 14 times in 7 days. Twice a day I OD'd.
What?
Yeah. I think I've OD'd over 300 and some odd times.
How did you manage to overdose that many times and yet remain breathing, like on this side of the ground?
Fast acting people. I don't know. It's just, I have luck, I guess. Like, I know guys that have OD'd over 200, 300, 400 times, like, kind of like me, but then I've heard of other people that have OD'd that many times, and then the last time was the last time. And that was it. They couldn't bring the person back.
During an opioid overdose, a victim may lose consciousness and the ability to breathe on their own. Dr. Kendall says this type of repeated trauma can cause brain damage.
Well, probably the most subtle impairments are those of the executive functions of the brain to do with critical decision-making, being able to plan ahead, being able to put off a reward for a period of time, etc. But also, if you have really serious brain injury, then you lose an awful lot of functioning, intellectual capacity, physical capacity, disabilities in movement, etc., like a stroke. It's due to lack of oxygen to the brain.
A key pillar in overdose prevention rests on being able to halt the effects of opioids if someone has taken too much and stops breathing. With quick action, overdose reversal medicines like naloxone save lives. Dr. Kendall explains how.
Opioids sit, the mu receptors in the brain are what get stimulated by opioids. That also has the side effect of depressing respiration and consciousness. Until you can bump those molecules off the receptors, they will continue, in simple terms, just to slow down or stop the breathing. So people who've overdosed, they lose consciousness, their respiratory rate goes down, their volume of air they're taking goes down, their oxygen levels go down, and if they go down far enough, because enough of their mu receptors are blocked for long enough, the oxygen supply to the brain stops. Naloxone, Narcan, and a few other drugs as well, will come in and they will displace their antagonists. They displace the opioid molecule from that receptor and allow the respiratory function in the brain to send messages to the lungs, so the lungs, the body will start breathing again. They will sometimes come around and they will be plunged into an unpleasant withdrawal. Compared with dying, that's a relatively benign side effect.
Peer supporters are often first on the scene of an overdose, calling 911 and beginning the response to attempt to save the life of a victim. Abbotsford's Roy Berry estimates he's performed somewhere around 600 overdose reversals.
If I'm out and about, I could usually do one a weekend, two a weekend. Sometimes, depending on the drugs that are out there, somebody may bring a particularly potent batch in, and there may be four in one tent. And I've had as many as four people down at one time. In my training, where I've trained in Vancouver Career College and whatnot, I trained how to perform a reversal alone. So it's difficult, and it requires some talent, but it can be done.
Roy describes what he looks for before intervening on behalf of an overdose victim.
Say, hey, buddy, you okay? And you try to get a response. Look to see if you can see their chest rising or their stomach moving. Look to see if their lips are moving, see if they're breathing. I've done so much of it that I've learned how to monitor the breathing. So I count the seconds between breaths, and I know when there are 5-6 seconds between breaths, they're either going to go up or they're going to go down. If they go down, great, they're coming back. If they go up, then they're working their way in the 7 seconds, 8 seconds between breaths, at 9 seconds between breaths, they're going to overdose. And just about when they get to 9 seconds, that's when they fall out of their chair. Check to see if their lips are blue. Their lips have begun to turn blue. They've stopped breathing, and they're dying. You do a sternum rub Like, take your knuckles very firmly and rub on the chest, right in the center of the chest, up and down on the ribcage. And they're going to push your hand away and go, hey, don't do that. Great. They're alive. That's what you want. Look for the response. Get a response from them.
And Roy says if a suspected overdose victim doesn't respond, he calls 911 and initiates his training to start naloxone treatment and mouth-to-mouth with the hope of keeping the person alive for long enough for help to arrive.
What I really want 911 to do is get that ambulance rolling towards me. Right? That's the number one thing. Once that ambulance is there, I don't have to do more work. This life is not on my head. Right? And the professionals are there that know what to do.
In the street drug world, peer support workers play a critical role beyond that direct response to an overdose. They share lived experiences with drug users and can relate. They help folks by offering outreach and assistance navigating social services. Not to be overly reductive, but they're basically a friend in a time of need.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
Remember Zeph?
I wouldn't consider myself sober, but I'm off all the drugs that were problematic and that kept me in addictions and stuff like that, right? Like, I still smoke cigarettes and weed, but I'm not on the pipe and I'm not drinking till I black out every day. So, like, I've got my life back for the most part from that. So that's how I can still have that relation, because my life was every bit of what you see out here 5 years ago. Right? And so that's how I come in as a peer, because I care. I grew up around it. And even if you've never yourself put a pipe to your lips, if you've grown up around it and some part of your heart is inclined to want to be a part of these groups, to be a part of the solution, you qualify as a peer.
While using drugs under supervision eliminates some of the risks associated with overdosing, another key element of harm reduction comes in the form of drug checking. Will McClellan says the information provided by Mountainside Harm Reduction's drug test strips and FTIR spectral analysis keeps drug users aware of what they're holding.
I'm taking a mystery powder that we've found in a random baggie, and I'm going to put it on the Fourier Transform infrared spectrometer. What that's going to do is shine infrared light through it, measure how it bounces off the chemical bonds, and create a spectrum, what you can think of as a fingerprint, essentially. And if there's more than one substance inside it, it'll look like multiple fingerprints, one on top of the other. And technicians for this project, we use our expertise to pry the fingerprints apart and figure out exactly what there is and roughly how much of it. If we could tell a drug user that, you know, that their particular batch contains 20 to 30 milligrams of fentanyl per point, then they can get a dose out of that.
Is there any way you can quantify how many lives you think you may have saved by helping people avoid dangerous stuff?
It would almost be irresponsible of me to speculate, but it's definitely more than one, so it's worth it. It's basically increasing the amount of available information for people. That's what we're about.
Zeph invites people to listen to the stories of folks who have fallen into cycles of addiction with empathy.
If you can try to find it in yourself, like getting down on their level, on your knees, and realizing that the only thing that really separates you people is luck. It's not choices, because God forbid you're ever in a car accident 10 years from now and you're in a coma for 6 months and then you can't walk for 2 years and you need pain medication the whole way to get back to normal. And then as soon as the doctor deems you fit to walk, you're kicked out and you're cut off, but now you have this addiction. Is your family supposed to shame you and kick you out because you have an addiction, or would you like help and support? Right? It's not a choice. It may have started that way, yeah. It could have been bad decisions, bad choices that led to it, but once addiction gets a hold of you, whether it's process or it's addiction, like physical substance, whatever, your brain's been rewired, right? It's a disorder, it's a disease, it's something that we need help and we need to help with.
We spend a lot of our time in life chasing dopamine, the neurotransmitter that makes us feel good, that gives us a high. Runners get a dopamine high when they stop running. Gamblers get a dopamine high when they win. Sex gives us a dopamine high. A good meal gives us a dopamine high. Alcohol gives us a neurotransmitter high. We are physically designed to go after that feeling of goodness. And a lot of people who fall into addictions to whatever it is are vulnerable people whose previous life experiences, whose childhood experiences, whose mental health experiences make them vulnerable to running after that high. Baby rats that are licked by their mums and feel loved, if you like, and have that sense of touch, will be more resistant to trauma when they're adults than baby rats that are ignored. And we know that the sort of love and the care and attention that humans get when they're growing up can be very important to how their epigenetics enable them to deal with stress and cortisone production. So if you've got a loved child, that child will be resilient. And even bad things won't have such a terrible effect on it as kids who are not raised with love or support, kids who were abused sexually or psychologically, whose needs for love were ignored. And they become kids who are very, very, very vulnerable to stresses and to, it's called adverse childhood experiences. And the more you have, the more likely you are to have problems in adolescence or in adulthood.
Whatever path in life leads someone into a cycle of addiction, getting out can be tricky, especially for folks without financial wherewithal or built-in family support.
If you're upper class or wealthy or a professional, you tend to have more social capital going for you. You have a better chance probably of getting through relapses and getting straight again.
Why don't you just stop? That's what I get. Why don't you just stop? Well, it's not that simple, okay? Have you ever tried this before? Because if not, then you have no idea.
Back in Mission along Logan Avenue, Aaron describes opioid withdrawal.
You hit that 24-hour mark and it's just like your whole body, how you feel and just, yeah, it's different for everybody, but me, it's like I'm having a panic attack. It feels like I'm like a butterfly trying to come out of a cocoon. I'm like, my skin is just crawling, and I just like, it's just, oh, like, if anybody ever's been to a native sweat before, and they like throw that one bit of hot water on that, those rocks, and it just hits you, all that steam, and it feels like all your skin's peeling off you. Yeah, that feeling, it's horrible, and it's like that, it's that hot, like, it's just, ooh, it's horrible feeling.
And only one thing will end it.
Yeah, and that's more.
It takes a while to come down from that because it changes the chemistry of the brain. And it takes a while to put the chemistry and the neurophysiology of the brain back together.
One first-line therapy option to help wean people off of opioids is the methadone program.
It's been doing me good.
Is it working for you?
Yeah, yeah.
That's Owen in Mission.
Since I've been on methadone, I don't steal for my fix because you don't really need it, right? So take it or leave it.
Every year, up until recently, about 24,000 British Columbians start methadone. You don't get a buzz off it. All it does is stop you going into withdrawal symptoms. The longer you're on this program, the more likely you are to manage to get away from the drugs and achieve stability and recovery. Our six-month retention is about 50%. And last time I looked, our 12-month retention in that program was around 30%.
Dr. Kendall says in spite of methadone offering that narrow shot at recovery, some people continue to discount it as an invalid form of treatment.
This is an attitude that people are imbued with, that addictions are wrong, addictions are a moral failure, and that if you're taking methadone or buprenorphine, you're still dependent on a drug and you haven't made a full recovery.
Opioid addiction is a notoriously difficult fight, and Dr. Kendall says the risk of a relapse must be addressed as part of any recovery strategy.
And to deny people access to a drug that could help them not relapse is bad therapeutics in my mind. One notable thing about opioid dependency is that relapse is very common. If you have gone abstinence-based through either a treatment system that's weaned you off drugs or you've been put in jail and you've been weaned off drugs, should you relapse and go back to the street, you will have lost your tolerance. And the dosage that would make you high previously will kill you this time round. Now, if you don't relapse, relapse to drug use, you're fine. That's great. But the rate of relapse is very high, and it's seen by many in the treatment system as a failure and a stigma. And so rather than trying to relapse-proof people by telling them this is an issue, that if they're starting to feel the need to use again, they can come back to you and get, maybe increase your dose of methadone or take something else. They feel ashamed about it. It's a failure. They don't want to admit to it. They do it in the quiet in the room with street drugs, and they die.
Especially the young men that are using.
That's Ernestine.
In almost all those cases of the young people that I knew personally, they used alone because they were embarrassed. They didn't want people to know that they were using. And they died, you know, in their car, in their trailer. And they were basically healthy young males, but because of the toxic, poisonous drugs, they died, and the families were shocked. So they didn't want to tell anybody what happened. I just think it's so important that we spread the word, stop the stigma, no more shame, no more blame. It's okay to talk about. It's important to talk about.
Those lost to the toxic drug crisis will not soon be forgotten. In Mission, Jeremy Liebrecht says he knew Zach since they were kids.
He was a really good part of this community. He tried to help as much as he could as well.
Zach was really kind-spirited.
That's Rose.
He always tried to make any situation funny.
He would light up the room whenever he walked in, you know.
Found out he passed away. Overdose.
He was actually, he got clean before the last couple months before he passed away, and that's what I mean. These drugs are so strong now, you take a break even, and you want to relapse, just you got to be careful, because that's what happened to Zach, and we all never thought that that would ever happen to him, right?
Owen says that he's missing a lot of people.
I don't have a single person left. Everyone I've ever loved is dead from opiates. It's countless, actually, the people that you know that would die from fentanyl overdose.
The toxic drug death crisis disproportionately affects Indigenous peoples. For example, BC's First Nations Health Authority reported in 2023 that Indigenous people are greater than 6 times more likely to die of an overdose than other BC residents.
Part of the drug addiction problems stems from years of colonization, residential schools, and the survivors, and they're still coping, trying to survive.
There's generations of intergenerational trauma.
And when children grow up, when in their own homes, their parents can't even parent them because they're struggling to survive through the trauma of what happened to their parents. And it's like a vicious cycle. So from an Indigenous focus point, we try to encourage that culture and land is medicine, good medicine, and it's healing.
They got to be loved. Somebody's got to love them.
People need to be properly trained with how to use naloxone.
We're all in it together, right?
There's always help, right? Like, talk to people.
Unless you've gone through it firsthand or vicariously, it's a layer of trauma that you don't want to project onto people just for their own education.
Mom and dad, talk to your kids.
We need to stop the shame, be non-judgmental, and love unconditionally. Let's make change so that we save some lives.
For Viewpoints and for the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Mike McCullough.
Thanks so much to Mike McCullough and his many guests for filling in for us this week. Mike will also be with us again next week with another story, this time about musician Shamir Virgo. Do not miss this beautiful documentary. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative. For comments, story ideas, or just to tell us more about yourself, please write to us, radio@frequencynews.ca. Our website is frequencynews.ca. That's it for us this week, and until the next, ciao. We'll be right back.
email is radio@frequencynews.ca.